Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 47.
Soraksim. That's Russian.
We're in Spain.
We are, well, we're not currently in Spain, but we will be in Spain when we release this podcast.
What will we be doing in Spain, Lynn?
On our honeymoon.
But even though we'll be traveling, we do have a podcast episode for you that we pre-recorded a few weeks ago.
With Trav SD.
So never fret, we got your circus podcasting needs covered. But before we get into it, there are a few interesting sort of articles that came out this week. One I saw this morning that had a bunch of really amazing photos about the Russian State Circus School.
Yes, it was in the New York Times. It's an article called "These Graduates Throw Themselves, Not Caps, in the Air."
Not caps like graduation
caps?
Yeah,
which I had to read the title a few times because I was like, what? I was like, oh, I get it. Like graduation caps.
What's the article about?
It's about, I might be butchering the name of this, so apologies to anyone who speaks Russian or can pronounce this school. Sorry. It's about the Rumyantsev State School of Circus and Variety Arts. It's in Moscow. And it was created in 1927 by the Soviet People's Commissariat.
Sounds right.
Commissariat. Close. Of Education. And it's a four-year program with 180 students who attend free of charge. And they bill themselves as the world's first full-fledged circus school.
Well, I guess they've been around for 90
years. I guess it's
the
Moscow Circus School, as it's commonly known. But they've been around for years. And it's basically an article. It starts out by saying, like, even though Ringling is dead in the United States, the big top lives on in Russia, which, again, is just, like, so not a true statement. It's basically equating Ringling dying to circus in America dying, but it's still going on in Russia. I am jealous of how much Vladimir Putin likes the circus and funds it, if only our crazy pants Trump could like the circus, too.
Yeah, I gotta say, as podcasts go, we do talk about Trump more in this podcast than any other one that I think that I think we've done. So just a sort of a spoiler for those ahead.
I mean, there isn't much to actually in this article. It's a lot about the kids who
some really good
are graduating and really good photos. So I recommend just looking at the article for the photos. But it's basically saying it's just a great circus school. That's really
not that the New York Times would really know.
No.
There was another article this week in the Philly Voice from Philadelphia about, well, really it's titled America's First Circus School Opens in Philly's Doors Next Month. I don't know if it's technically the first circus school, but Circadium, School of Contemporary Circus, is opening up in their brand new building that they're doing right now. They're starting their full-time three-year training program, and it's going to have some kind of accreditation. Pretty exciting stuff. We're going to have Shana Kennedy, who's one of the founders and lead producers, creators of this circus school on the podcast in the next few months to talk about what they're doing. Kitsy O'Neill, one of the co-owners, said in this article that Circadium, in addition to offering typical circus classes in performance and acrobatics and aerials and dance and theater and music, is also going to be focusing on entrepreneurship and how to make a living from circus. She said, "Where you go to school is where you end up, but there is an art movement in Philadelphia that's so expansive." So it'll be interesting to see if this school sort of starts to help Philadelphia become more of a hub for circus performance and circus activity. Mm-hmm. That'd be great for us. It's only like an hour train ride from New York City and less expensive for artists to live in.
Yeah. You know, I'd be interested to take their class of like how to make a living in circus because we had some of those classes, you know, at Columbia about theater. And I feel like everyone's path is just so different. You can't like replicate it. And a lot of the times when people are like, this is how you do it, this is how you make a career, you know, that's like how that one very specific person made their career happen. And, you know, from the podcast, you can hear that everyone's path is so different, like the same, because we're all in the same genre of life, but different paths. So I don't know what a class on like how to make a career in the circus arts is going to be about, but I think it's important that they are trying to teach it.
Well, I think the one class that I would say, looking back on my own years of education, was this class taught by the director Ann Bogart called Visiting Directors, which is basically a version of our podcast where you just have a guest in every week to tell their story and somebody asks interesting critical questions of this person's experience. And that has taught me way more than any class about like build a website and, you know, obviously when it comes to entrepreneurship, there are things that one can be taught about how you open a business, about how do you do accounting, how do you read contracts, which are things that Lindsay and I have written about in articles and talked about on the podcast, the importance of educating students about those things. So it seems like they will include some amount of that in their program. But the question of how do you make a living is kind of different from how do you be an entrepreneur? Because entrepreneurship, more often than not, the things you start fail or don't make money, or it takes a while to figure out how to get it all going, as evidenced by our journey, you know, on with Hideaway that we've been talking about for over a year now. I'm really excited to hear about it. I'm excited to have Shayna on the podcast in the next couple of weeks. Too.
There's one other thing that is kind of old news, but I think it's worth saying, is that there's, you know, the Commonwealth Circus Center in Boston, or C3 as they call themselves, is opening a brand new studio in Jamaica Plain. So if you're in the Boston area, that should be open in September.
Great.
On our podcast today, we have Trav S. Day.
So I've seen Trav's posts on his blog, Travelanche, for years now. He posts regularly. He's a really, really excellent writer about circus and variety and theater history. He has a book that many people have and is sitting on our shelf called No Applause, Just Throw Money. And I was really excited to have him on, in particular because I had read a speech he did at Coney Island called Why the Circus is So Un-American. And we sort of talk about why it is American and what's un-American about it, and some of these sort of big American ideals like capitalism and individual rights, and how those things sort of play into circus historically and what's happening to the circus now. And Trev's a really good example, not totally this one, actually, from Catherine Cavanaugh, who we had on earlier, who's somebody who's managed to figure out a way to write about circus and variety for a living and really have this big picture critical eye of the industry that I think is is much, much needed. So for those of you a little bit more interested on the academic side, on the critical side, on the historical side of circus and variety, I think this episode is going to be just perfect for you.
Perfect for you.
But before we let you listen to the podcast.
Yes, before we let you listen to the podcast, you must pause your podcast and go like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, tweet us, rate us on iTunes, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. Here's our interview with Trav S. D.
Are you from Rhode Island originally?
Yes.
Where in Rhode Island?
Wakefield.
What is that?
It's near Narragansett.
Okay. Is it on the water?
Yeah, it's like, you know, 5 minutes from the water. So, yeah, actually, I'm giving a talk at Coney Island in a week, and that I sort of fold that in. I'm realizing one reason I love Coney Island is got to be because of that, growing up at the beach.
Was there a show you saw as a kid that made you like want to get into theater?
Well, you know, the very first sort of play that I ever saw was a field trip at Trinity when I was 13, and it was Waiting for Godot with Richard Jenkins and this guy George Martin. That, you know, I mean, it's like if there's like a first thing to see, that was pretty amazing. I don't know, like that it like...
That could have been so boring if you had two bad actors, though.
Totally.
That could have put you off theater.
It's, yeah, it was more like, it wasn't like an exciting show per se in that way that you just like, you know, a lot of movies will strike me that way. But as a first thing to see, it was... You know, you end up talking about it, you know, unless you're just like, I mean, a lot of people will just be like, oh, that's just boring and pretentious or whatever. But me, it was more like just kind of eye opening, you know.
And then if you want to be an actor?
Yeah, totally. Well, we just kept going to Trinity Rep on field trips, you know, from the age of 13. And my school had lots and lots of theater classes because it was the 70s and early 80s, so they still had arts at school.
Right.
So I had unnaturally, you know, I had like the equivalent of what you would get, I would say, is like a college freshman or sophomore in theater history, and you know, and then all sorts of performance, you know, it was definitely theater 101 by the time I was 13 or 14.
Were your parents supportive of you, of that interest, or were they...
Are we already rolling, or is this the backgrounder?
Oh, no, we're rolling.
Oh, I didn't even know. That's cool. I would have been much more charming and witty if I knew we were rolling. My parents are, they're interesting. They're both from rural and kind of rustic backgrounds. I come from a working class background. And so, you might think, you know, they would sort of gently encourage me into, say, a business major or whatever. But also, I think I kind of blew their minds a little bit. And so they were just like, whatever you want to do. I mean, from the time I was 13, I was very precocious and very well read and stuff like that. So they were just kind of like watch and wait as far as what I was going to do, I think.
I saw also you went to NYU Film School, which is where I went for my undergrad.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I didn't finish, but you know, that had always been my dream. And when I got a little bit older and on my own, I could qualify for the financial aid. So I went there for a couple of years and it was cool. It was very competitive in a way that I'm not, you know. So like I sort of was disgruntled about the fact, you know, when you get an assignment in the sort of first year classes, you all sort of had to sort of scramble to get your hands on equipment and stuff. And they sort of pretend that, well, that's part of the lesson of filmmaking, you know, and it's kind of like, well, yeah, except I'm paying all this money. I'm still paying for it. So, you know, I wasn't too happy about that aspect. But what was great about NYU is I didn't feel like thrashing around in those classes. So I ended up taking film studies, like criticism classes. And I realized pretty quickly in retrospect that when I started getting assignments to do theater criticism or to write, say, about vaudeville or movies and stuff, I definitely got the tools for writing about art at NYU. So that was good.
Is that what brought you to New York, that school, or did you come?
More like, you know, actually here's the mind-blowing experience that made me want to get into theater was on a field trip, we came to New York City and saw West Side Story on Broadway, and that blew my mind. So, you know, I always connect theater and New York, and for me it was much more about just coming to New York and living in Oz, the most fabulous place in the world. So there was that, definitely just wanted to come to. And so NYU is like, it's here, you know, and it's the great East Coast cinema school. You know, I think didn't Scorsese go there?
Yeah, and really, there's like an indie bent to it as well.
Yeah,
like
totally. And Woody Allen and Spike Lee. Well, yeah. Woody Allen just had a semester, but
I think Spike Lee teaches there now.
Probably.
And were you seeing circuses and variety shows and sort of the other side of that world as well at that time, or did that get introduced to you later?
Well, I mean, there weren't really variety shows to see back then, and it's all post, you know, 1990s or so, you know. So when I was a kid, I saw the circus. I mentioned this, I think, in that talk that you were referencing. We went to see Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus when I was about 10. It came to Providence, and we hated it. I'm very critical about circus because I am disappointed in almost every live experience of the circus I ever see. I want it to be the fictional circus of stories and movies. And that's kind of what I have in my head. So, you know, yeah, there's three rings happening at the same time. It's loud. It's obnoxious. It's not quaintly traditional. This is, you know, in the 70s.
You also said this in this article that we're going to talk about later.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, we saw the last show.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it was so like Disney on Ice.
Yeah.
And it was like the kids behind us were more interested in their glow up, like light up toys, and they kept hitting our heads with them. And, you know, they weren't even really like looking at the clowns because it's like an arena, and but it was just so glossy and like blast off. You know, and so I think even if you're feeling that when you saw it when you were younger.
Yeah,
it's like,
totally. Yeah, that's what it felt, very commercial, you know. So there's this been, for me, there's always been this feeling of a wanting to find a lost experience that might be out there. That, and sometimes I'll get a piece of it, you know, some show or some people will turn me on. But yeah, when I was like very young, 6 or 7, I wanted to put on a puppet show. I ran away from home, and it was very much inspired by like Huckleberry Finn and Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz, and, you know, with the Bindle Stiff on my shoulder, to name some other people who were clearly inspired by the same kind of thing. Yeah, I literally ran away from home when I was 5 years old, and just thinking I would just go and have adventures.
Did you make like it out of Rhode Island?
No. Wow. No. This easily could have been a tragic story. We'd be talking to a ghost now. But no, my brother's girlfriend spotted me 2 miles away as I made my way to the beach.
But I guess you never really lose that want in a way.
Wanderlust. Yeah, yeah. I still wish. I'm in the back of my head, I'm planning a solo show because I just want to tour and see the world that way. Mm. I've not yet had that experience. I really want to.
So when I was doing some research on you, I found a few interesting sort of pieces of your early backstory I want to ask about. Mm. You worked with Tony Bennett when you were
starting. I did. It was one of my first jobs when I came to the city.
How did that happen?
A friend worked for him, and she got the job through a friend, I think. So, yeah, that was a real trial by fire. I definitely had my feet put to the fire in that. It was very high pressure. I threw up on my first day of work. But I don't know if it was the stress of the job or just eating hot dogs from the dirty hot dog water, or a combination of the two. But yeah, it was, and it was just as his son Danny, who's kind of a wizard and a guru, because he engineered this amazing comeback when at the time when I started there, that was just beginning. But prior to that, you know, like in the 70s and early 80s, he was very considered very passé and that whole thing. And Danny figured out a way to brand it and make that special, you know, to make it to make Tony seem like this just a lightning rod of magic and poetry and romanticism that had died. But for a while there, like, nobody appreciated that. You know, they thought he was like Stephen Eady, you know, Stephen Eady art, or like Vic Damone or somebody. He was just kind of passe.
Huh.
Lounge.
That's kind of interesting, though, being able to see that be turn there around. For that change and that turnaround of image.
Yeah, it was an eye-opener.
And then shortly after you were with Big Apple Circus, maybe not shortly, but I also
saw a couple of years. Yeah, in between I was my NYU stint.
Yeah.
And then I got out of school and got the Big Apple Circus job through a friend who knew that I could write. And so I started writing grant applications. Mm-hmm. Then I became the membership manager and learned a lot. I met a lot of people. I ended up booking for vaudeville shows and ended up learning a lot about circus management and, you know, arts management and to the whole Magilla, really.
People I wonder, I'm still friends the development with. Scene must have been pretty different back then than, say, like, 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, it's like when you get a little bit older, it's kind of like, you know, so like, it's like the boy who cried wolf, you know. So like 20, 30 years ago, people were, oh, there's no money, or, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And it just got like worse and worse and worse. And it'll probably get worse. So it's kind of like, oh, man, we shouldn't have done all of that weeping and crying about how hard things were back then, because things were really great in retrospect. So, yeah, Big Apple Circus always had that a niche problem, because it's unusual to be a not-for-profit circus. So part of the challenge was sort of educating people that some of the choices are not necessarily as commercial. And Big Apple Circus has never been obnoxious in that way that Ringling Brothers was. Mm. With the merchandising and stuff, and
well, we'll see though coming up. I mean, they could
yes, the new identity. In fact, it's a question I've wanted to sort of get to the bottom of this, because it's still an open question in my mind. I've done a little blogging about it, but I'd like to maybe try to get a writing assignment where I can sort of get to the bottom of what's happening. Is it still a not-for-profit? Or, you know, I know they bought the tent, they bought the equipment and the rings and stuff. But what I don't know is, you know, and they bought the brand, but did they... I don't think
it
you
is
buy
for it. Profit now.
It is for profit,
yeah,
right?
Big
so that's
Topworks LLC.
Yeah, so that's a little confusing. It's pretty unprecedented. It's probably actually smart, and they'll still be in the one ring, which means they'll have probably a certain amount of integrity. I mean, I always feel like there's integrity to making, showing the one thing.
Right.
You know, you must know, like at the height of circus, there were like 7 ring circuses.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And there's like, you know, 30 elephants going all the way down one side.
And, you know, they didn't have TV at home. So that it was just a thrill and people were less critical back then. But now I just want to watch one thing.
Me too. Yeah. I mean, it's just like I was saying with Ringling. It's an arena and there's so much happening. There was like ice skating happening around and then like there was, but it's so at the other end of the room. Yeah. You can't even see the clowns are all at the other end and I can't see. And then there's like some weird hand balancing that's like on ice skates. I mean the whole thing, but I mean, I did like the Big Apple show as far as it being like one act at a time. Mm-hmm. But I'm interested to see because it seems like the same exact team that they had.
Yeah. Before, so that's heartening.
Coming back.
Yeah.
How did your writing career really start to become your focus as you know Big Apple ended and your journalism and book writing?
Yeah, you know, I sort of I actually still am heavily involved in theater. My last thing was an acting gig. You know, I still act and do things. But what happened was, you know, you get paid. So, and things were, when I started around 1999, 2000, realizing that I could pitch things. And things were much better then. There was that internet bubble that hadn't yet burst. So you got paid for reviewing things on the internet. And I got writing gigs I got a fellowship in American theater. And wrote for the Village Voice. And, you know, it's showbiz, so it's contacts. You know, I knew the editor. And then I had written for a free indie zine back when the zines were a thing. You know, you photocopy your own magazine, which was, it came out of the punk movement, but it was still going on. And around the same time that the Fringe Festival was being born. So David Cody and another partner had started a zine and I wrote for that for a while. And then Cody was writing for Time Out New York under Jason Zinnemann, who's now at the Times. So I wrote for Zinnemann and then for Cody when Cody took over, that kind of thing, you know. So and then that led to a book.
So what brought you two from like the theater and film world into this vaudeville kind of underground?
There was always, you know, I think probably the one catalyzing factor was working at Big Apple Circus. I got really envious of the performers and stuff. And also Bindle Stiff Family Circus was also a influence. I'd always had the romance of theater, like I said, right? You know, I ran away and I was disgruntled by the real Ringling Brothers. I always wanted to make a show like that happen. So I just started doing it. I started putting on vaudeville shows around the mid-90s. So that was it. And then for the longest time, I've tried to sort of juggle doing variety with theater plays that I write. And it's hard to integrate. It's really hard to integrate the two.
Yeah.
How would you describe vaudeville to somebody who is like a student or somebody who's learning about circus and theater?
I would say that vaudeville is very closely related to circus. It even has animal acts, even though now in circus we're losing the animal acts. Highly variegated program or menu of performance disciplines all under one rubric. And then usually I will sort of concretize it by saying what it literally is: comedians, dancers, magicians, ventriloquists.
So to me, like, that sounds like a variety show, right?
Yeah.
But the word vaudeville isn't really used. Like, I when I see a variety show, I never think of it as a vaudeville show.
Well, there's a couple of... Vaudeville is one of those words. It's similar to burlesque, actually. It's a word that has... that if you look it up in a dictionary, it's going to have several meanings. Mm-hmm. And people aren't necessarily always using the same definition when they talk about it. Like, usually when people say vaudeville died, or, you know, back in the vaudeville days,
right,
they're talking about this network of circuits that predated us having cineplexes and movies and radio and TV. Mm-hmm. So it was literally a business, a certain kind of business that died in the 1930s. And because of that, it's also acquired a connotation of a certain aesthetic that happened at that same time, which, you know, baggy pants comics and top hats and tap dancing and ventriloquism. And for a long time, that connotation was a bad connotation. And now it's kind of getting a good one again because that stuff's being revived.
But Bill Irwin is, yeah, you know, such a good, yeah, example of a modern.
Well, he sort of revived it like a decade ago.
Yeah, yeah, but then he revived it again just recently. You know, I feel like
again and again and again. So I guess variety is the big tent, right? And even back in the day, they called it variety before they started calling it vaudeville. And then they started to brand it vaudeville because it was clean and they wanted to show that it wasn't the kind of things people saw in saloons or burlesque shows. Mm. So there's that too. But yeah, that's an interesting point that when you go to see just a general variety show now, you don't think of it as vaudeville unless it announces itself that way. Mm. Yeah.
And so your book, No Applause, Just Throw Money, how did that come about? Why did you want to write it?
I was really, really lucky. There was an editor with a lot of foresight at Faber and Faber who had read an article I'd written on the airplane and came to see a show of mine. And like there were like two or three of coincidences that sort of put me on her radar. And she asked if I had any book ideas. And I just so happened that I did, because I have a million ideas for things already. So I put together the proposal and they bit and then it came out. So I was very lucky. I don't know that I would have gone like shopping that around. You know, proactively, but it was already ready to go when she came to me.
So you have like innately this writing bug, I'm guessing.
Yeah, oh yeah, I write, I don't know, a zillion words a day. If I'm not blogging, I have sort of stuff that's like in the hopper ready to go. I write notebooks about what I see, plays and movies. I sort of don't look at something without writing about it.
So let's talk about Travelanche for a little bit, which is your WordPress, your blog. Mm-hmm. And you post every day, which to me seems like the most daunting task of all. But now listening to you talk a little bit, it seems like you couldn't not write every day.
Yeah. I have this calendar laid out. And a lot of what I do is reposting. So it seems like I do a lot more than I do, actually, because I started it in 2008. And so And I work off of birthdays or significant anniversaries usually. So if a bunch of things happen on a day, you know, there'll be like maybe one or two new posts and then like six old posts, mm-hmm, that I'll freshen up and put out there. But yeah, lately it's been lots of chorus girls, like Ziegfeld girls, and I'm branching out into movie stars. A lot of them I hadn't realized have as much. I used to be very strict about if they had a vaudeville connection or a circus connection, mm-hmm, or a sideshow connection. And then I'm letting it embrace Broadway reviews, which are very similar to vaudeville. Mm-hmm. And then if you do that, you get lots of big movie stars because they started out that way.
When you're doing sort of research on these old movie stars, are there like lots of movies you can't find because they get lost in the process?
Well, now things are just thrillingly accessible, you know, so yeah, much less so. I mean, there are the things that are permanently lost and they're just lost, you know, so there's that. You can't really do much about that. And then there are some things that are in hard to reach archives, like, for example, some of Harold Lloyd's work I've not seen, whereas I've seen everything that exists of Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton and a lot of other people. There's certain things of Harold Lloyd's you can't see because they're,
you know,
and there's not as much of a demand or whatever, or the family hasn't made, they need some restoration and that sort of thing. But yeah, mostly now we're getting to the stage where stuff if it exists, they're putting it out there. You know, it's pretty thrilling.
So I saw an article that I guess was originally a speech or a keynote that you delivered at Coney Island about when did the circus become un-American? Something that you could sort of summarize some of the main ideas in that.
Sure. Well, I have to say, I mean, I have to give the caveat that the theme of the talk was, it was like an assignment from Coney Island, USA's Dick Ziggin. I'm not sure that, I mean, yes, I have this jingoistic aesthetic. Per se, but I don't know. I would ever would have gone out there and put it out there unless I was given that assignment. So yeah, some themes, jingoistic is the wrong word, but I like, and as a critic, I have to say, I believe in a criticism that's highly subjective, right? So this is what I like, what I seek, what I want. It doesn't mean it's some universal thing that everyone needs to embrace or that that's all there has to be in the world. So, and then I realized, you know, circus is kind of perfect because, and vaudeville too, though I embrace this traditional Americana aesthetic, you know, stars and stripes and brass band music and stuff, it lends itself uniquely to the input of all cultures. So, so, you know, while that may be a the framework, right, you could have, you know, like all circus disciplines, practically acrobats, tamers, magicians, clowns, all of these disciplines can be entirely international because there's little speech required, you know, from anyone almost except for comedians and the master of ceremony and singers and things. You can even have international singers though. But yeah, you have acrobats from China or Vietnam or Italy or, you know, and it all goes together and makes this big tasty soup, you know? So it doesn't have to be like some, you know, who knows what America even is, but for me, it's immigration largely. So vaudeville uniquely tells that story and circus does too. And also, you know, then there are the ways other groups sort of twist that old thing. So like you have the march, right, which is German. John Philip Sousa is Portuguese already. He's like changing that. And then in the hands of African-Americans, it becomes ragtime. You know, that's essentially what that is. So, you know, there are these beautiful twists on the old. And I guess what I love is a continuity and a sort of chain of stuff, but what I don't like is sort of going to it, right, and it's like metal and, you know, and stuff that just blows my mind. You know, they want to make it futuristic or whatever, and that's fine, but I need some kind of, I need my hand held.
One of the most amazing parts, I think, reading the summary or the text version of the speech is when you sort of talk about the balance between individual rights and exploitation, both in American culture and circus. I wonder if you can sort of touch on those two themes.
Sure. Well. Yeah. I mean, what brought me there, I think, was animal rights, but it also really comes into play because, I mean, among the worst traditional employers in America have probably got to be circus owners, but for the fact that the people love the work so much that, right, you know, they ran away from home to do it and they'll endure long periods when they don't get paid. I'm not implying that current, you can't get away with the traditional circus management model nowadays, but there used to be days where like the circus didn't make its nut, and so you wouldn't get paid, and then you're just trapped. You
and
just
like Brazil or, you know,
yeah, right,
traveling far abroad,
and then you're, you know, and then you're have to, I mean, they feed you and they house you and stuff, but you can't get away because you don't even have any money. So so yeah, there's that conundrum, and this, but I have to admit there's a certain poeticism, certain tradition of we kind of like P.T. Barnum a lot, and we kind of like him because he's a little bit of a rogue, and but, you know, that said, I mean, and he's really been one of my heroes for like a long time because I like the playful hoax, the sort of bringing entertainment out into the world and stuff. And for the most part, you'd have to be a real stick in the mud to like just be mad about the things he did, you know. But then we elected one. So now I'm in this horrible place of just, oh, like my whole life's work. I have to like reexamine all of this because it's like the, you know, this reality TV star who hurts people, you know, hurts people. So I there's no way I can take a look at this ever again without. And this was true before, but now it's unprecedented. It's like at the highest level of our country, its philosophy is like, it's like glaringly there for us to look at and contemplate and question. In and it's not good. It's terrible. You know, we don't want to run the country like a circus. No, like an evil circus.
Isn't there, I think it was like Jessica Hentoff, you know, Jessica Hentoff.
Is she Nat Hentoff's daughter?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So that's, we're like talking across the generations now. Nat Hentoff is a hero of mine.
Yeah.
So,
okay, yeah. He passed away last year, right? Or recently.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But she, and she is, she was a podcast guest and a friend of ours. And, but she posts these great articles all the time. And so every time she posts an article, I always read it. And there was like this one article that was like, you know, we're referring, why is the word circus referring to like always like a negative thing, right? Like,
yeah.
Like, and you just even said it too, like this is a circus.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh gosh, like what is it about the word circus that is, even people say it, they're like, oh, well, it's like running a circus.
They do it with vaudeville too. If you Google vaudeville, you'll find many, you know, today's parliament meeting was a bloody vaudeville, you
right.
know. I think it's not, I don't think you have to read so much into it. I think it means like, in that sense, it's like a funny show.
Yeah.
And we don't want our, you know, our leaders as clowns right. putting on funny show.
Right, a funny
it's
show.
The stakes are too high for a funny show.
So, I think this is all staying in the same world. But one of the things that you're talking about in that same article is like how you can no longer sell a glass of water as like from the Holy Land and that be part of the theatricality right. of the moment. Although I'm sure Trump could do that and people would love yeah. it. But I'm wondering if you can sort of talk about if you feel like there's a cultural change in what people are expecting or like they want the truth or they want what's real. Or so I guess that goes back to the point you also made about how like is circus really dangerous still in the same way that it used
right.
to be? And does that risk is real?
On the one hand, you know, it's like the horns of a dilemma, right? On the one hand, yeah, I said that you know, you want the wiggle room to say that your 7-foot man is a 9-foot man, right? Just the world becomes more fabulous if you do that. And I don't want to know the truth. I kind of want to go with that. Or that odd looking person is from Mars, you know, or whatever. On the one hand, and then back in the day, there used to be medicine shows, you know, and
it's a medicine show.
Oh, really? Wow. Okay. That is kind of the oldest root of all of this. Back in medieval times, back in the fairs, there were these guys called mountebanks. And you'd get up there and you'd sell the medicine. He was kind of a doctor, but also kind of a showman.
Like they'd be on like a little wooden box.
Right.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
exactly
right.
What this is.
So, you know, it's related to Commedia dell'arte and mm-hmm. stuff. And, you know, he'd have his assistant called the zany or whatever.
Isn't
and so
there a whole musical about... Is that a doctor who like travels to town to town, like selling this miracle medicine?
Oh well, maybe the Music Man.
Maybe.
In that one, he sells like trombones or
yeah,
musical
no.
instruments.
Yeah. But Google it.
But that's the tradition of it. Yeah. So it, you know, it starts as long ago as that, like medieval fairs and marketplaces and stuff. And they put on shows, but they're also going to sell you. You know, it could be a bag of herbs back then. Mm. And then it grew to, you know, it continued and then it came to America and that became a whole form in itself. And there were these patent medicines, which would usually be alcohol based. But it, you know, it could range anywhere from poison to like at the other end, it's like Coca-Cola, really, you know, you make these claims about it, that it can cure anything and stuff. But then during the 20th century, you got all these laws coming in that sort of made that impossible, you know, because it's a lie and it's not true advertising and it won't really cure A, B, and C. The thing is, because the placebo effect and the fact that lots of it had alcohol, some people, you know, would swear by it. But, you know, if you're stealing people's money, da-da-da-da. But unfortunately, what also goes away is the whole show that went with it. It was called a medicine show. And, you know, first they would come in wagons to your town and put on a show. And then later it was trucks. And it went
like, look how we've cured this person kind of show, or like sideshow oddity style.
Oh, you were just like, just, you know, what, you know, unfortunately back in the day, a lot of it would be blackface minstrelsy, but that was all showbiz had that, songs, dances. Some of the songs are like pitches for the product, but some are just songs to get you over to the wagon.
Check it out.
And that very much influenced advertising, you know, like radio picked it up and then TV. But also, how did we start on the medicine show?
Oh, like selling the holy water.
Right. So, so now we reach this point where, you know, as far as the law is concerned, that's only a swindle. That's pure and simple a swindle, and it's criminal. Unfortunately, there's this gray area, and you know, there's a place where it's overlapped by romance and theater and storytelling and the possibility of the what if, you know. The world gets very gray and bleak if you can't, if you lie is such a negative word. Yes, you can't embellish. You know, you want to weave stories, and you want to be able to imply that the stories are true, even though they're the product of your imagination, because that lends them.
Movie Fargo a little bit. I think that's a great example. I mean, not obviously it's on circus, but this movie Fargo by the Coen brothers opens up with text being like, this is based on a true story, all the names have been changed to protect the like living or the dead, or, and they just have a whole bit about it. So it sets you up right at the beginning being like, oh man, I'm going to see a true story, and the whole thing stylistically looks that way, and of course it's all made up and totally ridiculous, but it's all part of the like emotional arc you're going on is the belief that it is that it is true, and it doesn't ruin it later finding out that that's sort of just a device they use to like make you go, oh my god, I can't believe this happened the whole time.
Yeah. Or, you know, I mean, this is a tricky area, but religion is very much related to this. You know, people want to believe certain things. Mm-hmm. You know, you get your Elmer Gantry. I don't know if you know that book or that movie, but it's like, and then we get our president, right, who says just anything. And then, you know, so I don't know why I'm worried that it's dying out, because, you know, this morning I was just watching John Oliver talking about Alex Jones.
I watched the first half of that.
Yeah. Oh, God. You know, it's just like, it's given as news. You just say anything. And so we are sort of being launched back into that time of possibility. And it's like a really rocky sea. It's very terrifying. I just want to use it for showbiz. You know, I don't want to hurt anybody. But we have reasons for these laws that prevent certain kinds of speech that way, because it swindles people.
Sort of on the same theme, we were in Australia in February and March, and we interviewed this circus producer there named Lauren Eislinger, and she was sort of telling us what she thinks is going on in Australian circus, which is that all the tented shows are going to the rural areas where there's no animal regulation, and they sort of play to these just more, you know, I think we would describe it as like the Midwest here, because people who are living a different style of a lifestyle rather than in like an urbanite elitist, I'm using that in air quotes, style, and that all the other shows, everybody who is living in those cities is just seeing proscenium style circus shows, which in Australia is like group acrobatics basically, with like tights and like black tights and
like
black ground
shirts. Yeah, ground.
And as she was sort of talking about that, I was like, oh, maybe that's sort of happening here as well, where if you live in New York City, you're going to see the things that come to BAM and the things that come to Lincoln Center, and maybe still Big Apple Circus, but now with this new animal regulation, I don't know how Universal's going to pitch up a tent here.
Or Vasquez, right?
Or Vasquez as well. And it just seems to be this like split that's really happening. And Ernest Albrecht talked about it, I think, in Spectacle like 2 months ago. how he sort of sees that depending on where you live, you're either going to see one style of circus or another, and that it's very rare that you're going to be in a place that can do that has both in it, where you're going to have touring style mud shows or like the bigger version of that, which I guess is Vasquez or Universal or something that's just a bigger production, or you're going to see James Thierry and all these different French and Canadian and Swedish circus corps come in, and that you're likely to only really see one or the other thing.
That's not good.
No,
this makes me sad, because I mean, we're right now, if anything, those two populations really need to be talking to each other and getting back together, and we're just going being driven farther and farther apart. I don't know what the answer is. You know, I feel like New York's the law is a bit too broad and extreme right now. As far as elephants go, I've come around. You know, they're so smart, they're so big, they need a lot of room. But you know, equestrianism, that's different. I feel like it's the law is too harsh, especially if there are people who haven't been proven to have been cruel. You know, if there's, we have cruelty to animal laws in place.
Yeah, I think horses and dogs, you know, for me is hard to argue against.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah.
And then of course, as you get more exotic, then you can sort of have that discussion. But I used to really feel very strongly that there was no place for exotic animals. And then I went to the last Rumble show and heard Alexander Lacy talking about the Big Cat Act. And I, like, for the first time ever, the last time it's going to be in Ringling, I was right. Like, oh shit, I totally actually see the other side of this argument.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's never been good. I've never heard good stuff about the big cats. You know, it's like there's violence in both directions, and then they drug them, and you know, that's that said, when the Moscow Circus came and I saw the bears, it was really cool.
I've never seen a bear. We almost saw a bear act when we were in Budapest, but I've never, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I do want, that's on my plaque. Right? I want to see a seal act as well. Yeah, at some point.
What do they do with seals?
Lots of balancing things. Oh, like throwing things that they can catch and throw back.
Sort
of, I guess it's like juggling in a way. And I think they have like personalities that are kind of similar to like dogs and like playfulness and can do group things. So you're sort of mentioning it earlier, but that you're working on a new play. Sort of, what projects are you working on right now?
Oh, actually, yeah, I'm sort of, it's a bit on a back burner, but a solo show that deals with a lot of that stuff that we were talking about the medicine show and the swindle and the tradition of it and its different manifestations. Like I might play different characters, like a preacher and a medicine show guy and a used car salesman and all that stuff, and tie it to vaudeville. And you know, we love to be lied to so much, but it's terrible. It's like we're in a bad relationship.
Yeah, it is. We can't get out of that. No matter how many people tell us.
So we usually wrap up the podcast by asking the same three questions to each of our guests.
Mm-hmm.
The first is there been a piece of advice, good or bad, that you've gotten in your life that has really stuck with you?
I can't really think of any. I don't listen to anybody. Actually, yes, if that's a piece of advice, it's don't listen to anybody else.
I need to take that advice.
Yeah, you could really use
especially
that.
Especially at this wedding. I'm like, oh, what does this person think of us? It really doesn't matter.
No.
Except for what you think. Especially with, well, that's also really good as a critic, right?
Because
if you care about what other people think, then you're going to kind of
very much so. Yeah, yeah.
Which I think is what happened with the New York Times. And Isherwood and...
Did you hear that story?
Only vaguely. I didn't follow the whole thing. So, yeah, he was listening to people?
I mean, like, he was friends with all these big producers.
Oh, right.
And Scott Rudin and a few others. And then, you know, would give these shows glowing reviews.
Yeah. I've hurt some friends' feelings. It's not the best. Then you tend to start to, like, just not do it. Not to go see their things.
Then you're like, okay, I don't really...
So the second question is, we have a lot of people who are like circus students at NECA or in Philadelphia who are, I think they use the podcast as a way to like research and learn about circus. So I'm wondering if there's a book or a movie or a show that you would recommend that somebody who's 16 or 17 go see that, you know, would be really worthwhile.
There's this book about this American circus by Culhane. I forget his first name, but that's one I first read at the New York Public Library, and I've always loved that. I've eventually got it, and it's pretty dog-eared. I've always loved the movie The Greatest Show on Earth by Cecil B. DeMille. One of the things I love about it is it gives it the same weight, apocalyptic tone and importance that he gives to the Ten Commandments. You might as well be watching the story of Moses. So that's a cool one. The Charlie Chaplin's movie, The Circus, is really wonderful. I don't know, you know, how useful it is as research, but it's inspirational, kind of. It's magical. Those are some.
Those are great.
And the last question is, who do you think we should have on the podcast?
Well, the first thing that popped into my head is Todd Robbins. That's just, do you know who he is?
His name is really familiar.
He's best known as a sideshow performer, but really he's kind of encyclopedic on all of the variety forms. So, and I first met him at Big Apple Circus. He was the ringmaster for one season. He used to work in their clown care unit and stuff, but he's probably one of the premier leading sideshow guys, and younger people have sort of followed in his wake. And then he has a true crime show on the Investigation Discovery Network called, oh gosh, I can't think of the name now, True Nightmares. And it's very, it's a bit like a Twilight Zone presentation, and he sort of does the wraparounds, and they give true bizarre crimes. So they're not just like the gross and horrible crimes. Right. They're the bizarre ones, you know, where like, I don't know, somebody turns out to be your long lost twin kind of stories, you know.
Oh, great.
You know.
I'll have to check that out.
That sounds fun.
Well, Trav, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and chatting with us.
Yes.
Thanks for having me really on, fun. Guys. This is a blast.
And that was our interview with Trav SD.
If you like our podcast, make sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, tweet us, rate us on iTunes, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. Have a good week.
Peace.